This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna. Local reaction continues today after the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan and the dramatic scenes of Afghans trying to flee as American forces hastily evacuate Kabul. Governor Charlie Baker today said in a statement on Twitter that the Commonwealth is, quote, ready to assist Afghan refugees seeking safety and peace in America. And Baker called the situation in Afghanistan a catastrophe brought on by mismanagement. Here to talk about the latest on the ground and the Biden administration's handling of the withdrawal is Congressman Jake Auchincloss. He represents Massachusetts' 4th District. He served in the Marine Corps, commanding infantry in Helmand Province in 2012, leading combat patrols against the Taliban. Congressman Auchincloss, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you again.
So I just want to get your reaction here to what we're seeing now in Afghanistan, something that the governor says is needlessly endangering Americans and our allies.
The administration is winding down a 20-year, $2 trillion war in a country whose moniker is the graveyard of empires. So it was not going to be smooth sailing in this withdrawal. The fundamental point, though, is that this president finally, after two decades, has had the integrity to tell the American people the hard truth that we cannot win a counterinsurgency without a viable political partner in Afghanistan. And the complete collapse of Afghan resistance is a testament to the fact that we never had that partnership.
At the same time, I'm thinking about the fact that you fought there almost a decade ago. And I'm just wondering, in your time in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban, what did you learn about the situation there on the ground then and how it has changed now?
We could win every single battle against the Taliban for the next century. I mean, the U.S. military would clean the clock of the Taliban in every firefight, and we'd still lose the war because counterinsurgency, unlike counterterrorism, counterinsurgency is a political problem with a military dimension. Now, we had the military dimension, but we never had the overarching political endgame. To do that, you have to counter the insurgents, and you have to counter the insurgents with competent governance that can provide basic services, rule of law, a civil society in which all individuals can flourish. And instead of trying to plant those seeds in fertile soil over the last two decades, Afghan senior leadership lined their own pockets and devolved into corruption and incompetence.
But if we knew that in 2012, should we never have gone in before then, or should we have gotten out much sooner than we did now?
The mission in Afghanistan began as a counterterrorism mission. And President Bush was very clear about this, actually, in the months following 9/11. It was to deny a base of operations to terrorists who had the imminent capability and will to strike the U.S. homeland. And it was to bring to justice the architects of 9/11. Now, the counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan has actually been largely successful. Osama bin Laden, of course, is dead, and there have been no attacks against the U.S. homeland in the last 20 years. But under Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney in particular, that CT mission, narrowly scoped and military in nature, was allowed to mutate into a counterinsurgency boondoggle. And that should never have been allowed to happen. In situation room after situation room for 20 years now, smarter people than me have looked around the table and said, we can't win this thing. We can't win a counterinsurgency. And yet it took President Biden and his integrity to finally pull the plug on it.
Okay, so let's hear President Biden. He stood firm on his decision to pull the plug on it, as you describe it. Here he is speaking yesterday from the East Room of the White House.
I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces. That's why we're still there.
So, Congressman Auchincloss, does that mean that the last four administrations have not been entirely upfront with the American people on exactly what the mission was there after the counterinsurgency mission?
That's exactly what it means.
And yet we've been hearing since the early 2000s, we're almost there. We're leaving. We're you know, leaving strong institutions. We're leaving a self-sufficient army. Was there dishonesty coming from the Obama administration, the Trump administration, the Bush administration?
One of the most powerful flaws in human decision-making and in group decision-making is sunk cost bias, this fallacy that we've already invested so much. Just give us a little bit more time, more troops, more time, more treasure. We'll get it done, because nobody wants to turn the lights off. Nobody wants to be the commander in chief that provides over a withdrawal. And yet we saw that sunk cost bias governed the Afghan counterinsurgency campaign for 20 years. And really, I want to underscore why that's such a testament to the presidential decision-making of Joe Biden, is that he pushed to the side these powerful human biases and thought like a president should think in the Situation Room.
At the same time, Congressman, I'm aware that the president said as recently as July 8th that, quote, the likelihood that there's going to be the Taliban overrunning everything and owning the whole country is highly unlikely. Of course, that's exactly what happened.
A Taliban takeover of Afghanistan was one of the scenarios mapped out for the president as he made his decision. It was not an inevitability, but it was a possibility. What is clear is that Afghan security forces were even more demoralized and even less well-resourced by central leadership than even U.S. intelligence agencies had forecast. We put $80+ billion behind Afghan Army and Air Force resourcing and training, $80 billion. And yet Afghan Central Command couldn't get bullets and rations to the front lines when the Taliban were advancing. That was not a money problem. That was a corruption problem. If you were a frontline soldier and you knew that your commanders were lining their own pockets instead of getting you what you needed to fight the Taliban, would you stay there and fight? Absolutely not. In combat, it's leadership that holds the line, and Afghan leaders really fell down.
But Congressman, shouldn't the intelligence officials, the military officials, known that before this week?
Again, a Taliban takeover was one of the scenarios mapped out for the president. I think more important than the horsepower of the Taliban in advancing, more important than the lack of American firepower, is the lack of Afghan willpower.
You know, Congressman, let's talk about loss, because in thinking about Afghan willpower, I'm also thinking of the many Afghan citizens who've lost their lives, and also the American service men and women who've lost their lives. And so I'm just wondering if maybe to get a little intimate for a second here, but what do you say to a person who lost a loved one or suffered a terrible injury or someone who's had to flee from Afghanistan?
A 20-year effort in a nation as complicated as Afghanistan cannot be broken down into just a simple win or loss. To say that no progress was made is, I think, an unnuanced perspective on the last 20 years. A generation of girls went to school. A generation of women voted and participated in political life for the first time. How much of that progress is sustained, especially in the Kabul capital region, is going to be one of the hallmark questions of the coming months and years. But progress was made. And again, the counterterrorism element of the Afghan mission has been successful. There have been no attacks on the U.S. homeland emanating from Afghanistan. We brought the architects of 9/11 to justice. Just because a tightly scoped, well-understood mission was allowed to mutate into a boondoggle of a counterinsurgency does not mean that all of the sacrifice was completely in vain. Things are more complicated than that.
Sure. Of course, yesterday on our show, we spoke with Worcester sisters Fadia and Farouk Kohistani. They both came to the U.S. with their family. They were relatively young. They've both since graduated college. One went to Brown, one went to BC, and they're working in tech. And here's what they had to say about the sort of real human impact of what's going on.
It's the idea that for the past 20 years we've been, or 20 years or so, we've been feeding hopes and dreams to young women and young girls in Afghanistan that, hey, you too can get an education. You too can do what you want to do in this world and make a difference. Just to take all that away in a matter of days is absolutely devastating.
So again, sort of reiterating what you were just saying, of it was 20 years of young girls, women in Afghanistan being able to get an education, being promised that tomorrow would be better, and then to have that taken away in a matter of days. What do you say to them?
it's my fervent hope as well that seeds once planted cannot be totally uprooted, not even by the Taliban.
Just a hope. Okay. Congressman, I also want to ask you about the failures and corruption within the Afghan government, which you mentioned earlier. It's hard to watch these images of Afghans clinging to American helicopters, leaving their country, or crying in the street. Is there a responsibility on behalf of the U.S. government, on behalf of the U.S. people, to the civilians there, regardless of who serves in their government?
The United States has maintained control or has gained control of the international airport, is resuming both commercial and military evacuations between 5,000 to 9,000 a day through at least August 31st. We are going to prioritize evacuating our Afghan allies who are at special risk of Taliban reprisal, whether because they served as interpreters or contractors or were prominent advocates for the rights of women and girls or were journalists. The State Department and the Defense Department are working in concert to expedite these evacuations, and they have the full support of Congress in doing so.
Is there anything being done here in Massachusetts right now, either in refugee efforts or aid, to support Afghans seeking help or asylum? What are you and your colleagues in Congress working on?
Governor Baker, in his comments yesterday, made clear that Massachusetts is open to refugees, and I am strongly in accord with that. We as a Commonwealth and as a nation are immeasurably enriched, both culturally and economically, by welcoming those who are seeking a better life for themselves.
And what comes next for the region, for America's involvement or lack thereof now in Afghanistan? What would you like to see President Biden and the military do next?
The immediate mission, of course, is the evacuations. The sustained mission will be an over-the-horizon counterterrorism capability. What that means is no terrorists with the will and capability to strike the U.S. homeland can be allowed a base of operations anywhere in Central Asia. Obviously, Afghanistan would be the prime spot. And in our briefings with the administration in the coming weeks, that'll be a line of questioning that I'll pursue vigorously, is to understand what is the status now of al-Qaeda in the region.
So, Congressman, just in closing, I do wonder if you could reflect with us for a moment here about your time in Afghanistan and just how you're thinking back on your service, on fighting the Taliban and now seeing them in power.
Well, nobody wants to see the Taliban in power. The Afghans nor the Americans want to see them in power. But I'm not thinking of the Taliban right now. I'm thinking of the villagers with whom I worked when we were patrolling the villages, and I'm thinking of the interpreters who were attached to my platoon. I'm thinking of the kids that we used to give our rations to and our water to. I'm struck, as all Americans are, by thinking about what future they're going to have. And it's a future that we cannot architect for them from half a world away. It's a future that they're going to need to wrest control over themselves. And we'll partner with them as best we can.
And then are you hearing from any of those folks, now? Are you hearing from your comrades, your brothers and sisters in arms and your other friends that you met there in Afghanistan?
My district office has been helping to process visas and provide other constituent services as best we can for references that are coming our way. Yeah.
And finally, Congressman, thank you for your time today. I'm wondering what lesson you think we can all learn from this 20-year war, this engagement, the lives lost, and now this regime change in Afghanistan.
Well, I'd like to think we've learned our lesson as a country to not wage wars of choice, but I try to be a student of history. And so something tells me that there's going to be a Bush-like president at some point in my lifetime who is once again going to bombast and bluster his way towards a failed conflict. And whether or not I'm a member of Congress, I'll be standing up in objection to it.
Well, that's Congressman Jake Auchincloss. He represents the Massachusetts 4th Congressional District, served in the Marine Corps in Afghanistan in 2012. Congressman Auchincloss, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Hear that? It's the sound of seawater. A boat engine off the coast of the Cape. And just picture it. A great white shark literally chasing the boat for about 30 seconds. It's the kind of shark encounter that the folks at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy have with some frequency in the waters off the Cape. Just today, their Sharktivity phone app binged with an alert, another sighting 30 feet off Nauset Beach, and another sighting yesterday almost closed head of the Meadow Beach. For more on these seafaring swimmers, let's turn to John Chisholm, adjunct scientist of the Sharks Fisheries Science and Emergent Technologies Program at the New England Aquarium. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. First, did you see that video? We're going to have a link to it on our website, radioboston.org, of that shark chasing the boat. I mean, whew, I think they need a bigger boat.
Yeah, that happens. It doesn't happen that often, but over the years, it does happen. It's usually just curiosity. The sharks are curious about the camera being in the water. And a couple times we've even lost cameras to sharks that were especially curious.
Is that because they use their mouths to see the world? Is that why?
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly. You know, they don't have hands and they use their mouths. Like you said, they have to go up and test what they're looking at. And unfortunately, sometimes they take a camera or two.
Yeah, or more. And I'm sure we'll get to that in a second. But okay, so, you know, I can't believe we're already in mid-August. Where are we in shark season in Massachusetts? And is that even a thing?
Yeah, we're, as much as people associate the sharks with summer and summer's winding down, we're actually just getting into the upswing in shark activity in Massachusetts. The peak will be the end of September into October.
And why is that? Is it a water temperature thing? Is it a food supply? Why is the end?
It's
of September?
A combination of all of that. You know, a lot of people think that you know, the sharks prefer warmer water, but you know, some prefer cooler water. We got all the seals, you know, and the sharks are just migrating through the area like they have for years. And we've noticed since we've been tagging, you know, the shark season, as you call it, really starts to pick up. Even though sharks, you know, there's been sharks here since the spring, the numbers start to increase as we get into August and, you know, through September into October. And then as the temperatures drop, you know, the sharks migrate back south.
So I guess if you're a shark, every week is Shark Week. But, you know, I'm thinking of the Sharktivity app, and I love that app. I bring it up on my phone and just check to see where the latest sightings are. It's from the, like I said, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy. And so they have a number of pings there. And I'm wondering, do the sort of increased shark sightings that we're seeing, does that mean that there are more sharks or just that we're seeing more of them from the coast?
A combination of both. Again, there's definitely been an increase in shark numbers since they've been protected since 1997. And I just recently answered this question from another person asking about how come there were so many shark pings last week on a specific day. The week was quiet, and then all of a sudden, you know, there was a bunch of pings, did a whole bunch of sharks show up. And that is actually an artifact of people being on the water and looking. So days that the research team or the ecotourism boats or the spotter pilots are out, when there's good weather, you get more sightings. So, you know, that is reflected in Sharktivity. And on rainy days, you don't get as many sightings, but that doesn't mean the sharks aren't there. So Sharktivity is great for, one, collecting data. People can send in their sightings and we can keep track of you know, where shark activity is occurring, in addition to being able to put out our own shark sightings and, you know, the shark alerts to get out to the general public. But the real take home message from you should be looking at when you look at shark activity is, you know, that the sharks are here and they're in the coastal waters and, you know, not, you know, far offshore. Right. And if you look, you can go back on the app and look, you know, from 2 weeks to a month to a year and just, you know, you go and really spend some time and look, and you'll see that throughout the state, sharks are found, you know, everywhere. They're in Cape Cod Bay. They're, you know, the Cape, the eastern side of the Cape gets the most attention because that's where the most research is going on. And that part of the reason that's happening is because that's where the bigger seal haulouts are, and that's what attracts the sharks the most. But
so can I ask you about that, John? Because, you know, I want you to help us put the sharks sort of in the larger context of the health of the oceans, because I'm thinking rising temperatures. We saw the UN report last week, warming waters, also reporting, I think from just a couple of days ago, of the now third annual arrival of what's known as the blob, this low oxygen area in Cape Cod Bay. Are the sharks, for lack of a better metaphor, the canary in the coal mine, you know, of climate change here?
You know, you might get a different answer from different researchers, but I would say not necessarily. I mean, white sharks, one of the things that people, you know, don't really look back on is the fact that these white sharks have been here forever. This isn't new. You know, they're not expanding their range because of global warming. They've been here, you know, they predate European colonization. You know, Native Americans have, you know, burial mounds have evidence of white sharks. So they've been here. So it isn't, global warming isn't necessarily the reason we're seeing more. And obviously global warming is occurring and it will have an impact on the sharks and fish and, lobster and everything else. And we are seeing that in other areas. But for white sharks, they have a pretty wide tolerance for water temperatures. And they have their preferred temperatures, which we usually see they prefer temperatures in the mid-60s. But, you know, we've seen them in much warmer water and much colder water. So it's hard to say specifically white sharks are a canary in the coal mine. They're really benefiting from the fact that marine mammals were protected in 1972, so their food source is rebounding, and also that they were protected in 1997, so that their population is starting to increase.
And of course, then there are carry-on effects of other, you know, the apex predator doing well also means other fish and things in the sea do well. I do want to, you know, in our few minutes here that we have left, talk about safety, because again, I love the Sharktivity app. I check it out before I go in the water. But what's your advice to folks who are on our shores, on the Cape, about how to stay safe in the water?
The best way to stay safe is to do a little bit of homework before you go to the beach. And I can't stress enough, I reiterate this all the time to the groups I talk to, is when you're going into the ocean, you're going into a wilderness area. We don't look at it the same way as we look at, you know, the Amazon jungle, but it's just as wild. So you need to appreciate that fact and be prepared when you go to the beach. There's plenty of sources of information. The National Seashore actually has a great website that has all kinds of white shark safety tips. But the most important thing is, you know, just be aware of your surroundings. If you see seals or you see big schools of bait fish, you know, avoid them. Don't, you know, swim out with them.
And what if you see a shark?
If you see a shark, report it. You know, obviously don't swim out to it. you know, we tell people, you know, just when you're in an area where there's shark activity and like you said, you're following the Shocktivity app. You know, you can still enjoy the beach and go into the water. Just, you know, read the signage, listen to the lifeguard recommendations. You know, don't go out, you know, past your knees if there's recent shark activity. So there's plenty of things you can do to stay safe and also keep enjoying the beach.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that. That's John Chisholm, adjunct scientist of the Sharks Fisheries Science and Emergent Technologies Program at the New England Aquarium. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
The latest data from the state on COVID show a slight downtick in positive tests. The 7-day average is at a little more than 2.7%. And while that's down from last week, it's still more than double the rate reported about a month ago. And Governor Charlie Baker says those numbers mean the Commonwealth should stay the course.
You have to get the overwhelming proportion of people vaccinated, but you also have to do mitigation. And that gets to the controversial issue of mask wearing, particularly in the situation in schools. We've just got to realize that we're dealing with a public health crisis. And the more you get infections, the more spread you get, the greater opportunity the virus has to continue to evolve and mutate.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci there from CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday. But to summarize what the governor was saying, he's not considering changing masking guidance at this time. He's looking at the data. And, you know, having Anthony Fauci there explain masking, the federal government is expected to announce guidance on a third shot, a booster for most Americans, probably tomorrow. We're seeing latest reporting that they would get that booster shot about 8 months after their most recent dose. Oh, yeah, and the start of school is just around the corner. So there's a lot to talk about. Tuesday means Ask the Doctors. So what do you need to know about Delta, boosters, masking, schools? Call us. Ask your questions. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. And with us this week, Dr. Helen Boucher, infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center and interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And also with us is Dr. Philip Landrigan. He's a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Dr. Landrigan, welcome back to you as well.
Jamie, good to be here with you.
So I'm going to get to the news on boosters in just a second here, but I do want to ask you both, maybe we can actually hear the cut here from Governor Baker from just yesterday on not changing the masking guidance.
I'm not considering changing the mask guidance at this time. We pay a lot of attention to the data associated with case counts and with hospitalizations, and you can't look at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and look at our vaccination rate, our hospitalization rate, and compare it to where the rest of the country is. Vaccinations are the pathway out of this pandemic.
So do you agree with him, Dr. Boucher, that the data supports staying the course, no new statewide masking rules?
You know, I think it's reasonable. And, you know, just to complete, the governor's message has been that when one is going to be around people whose vaccination status we don't know or around the vulnerable, that includes older and immunocompromised individuals, we should consider wearing masks. And I agree fully with that recommendation.
And Dr. Landrigan, what shift in the numbers would make you recommend more masking or perhaps a statewide masking mandate?
Well, first of all, Jamie, I totally agree with the governor's statement that vaccines are the way out of this pandemic. That's so critical. And it's a message that we have to emphasize and reemphasize. But the issue of masking is so complex and so nuanced. And I think that, you, as you said in your introduction here, the opening of school is just around the corner. And I think we really have to think very carefully about masking in the context of school opening. So I'm a pediatrician, and therefore I pay a lot of attention to the guidance that comes out from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is the major pediatric association in the United States, and the AAP has made two recommendations in regard to school opening this fall. First of all, they have said that it's really, really important for children to get back in person to school.
Right.
For their education and also for all the social benefits, all the interaction that comes out of school. And in the next breath, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends universal masking for everybody who goes back to school, students, teachers, and staff, everybody who's in the school building. And the reason is very simple. Children under the age of 11 or 12 are not vaccinated, and they won't be yet for at least a few months. That means that the virus has potential to be actively spreading around in the school. And this is a time, even in Massachusetts, even though our numbers are way better than Texas or Florida, the case counts are going in the wrong direction here, which means the virus is spreading in the Commonwealth.
Right.
And I would say, in an abundance of caution, the proper tack to take here is that in the school setting, everybody should wear a mask. I know the governor and the health department have not quite come to this position yet, but I'm hoping that they're reading the guidance from the American Academy of Pediatrics, and we'll pay attention to it.
And we're going to get to calls in just a second here at 1-800-423-8255. But Dr. Boucher, I want to turn to you then on the masking front and ask, is there a hierarchy of quality of masks? And what I mean by that is, you know, we've all been masking for a long time here. We've got the cloth masks. We've got the disposable masks. Is there something we should be keeping in mind, the N95 masks? With the Delta variant now and schools opening, what type of masks should we be wearing?
Yeah, very good question. You know, the most important mask is the one that's worn correctly, that is above the nose and below the chin, and that is tightly fitting. There is a hierarchy of masks, and we know that a surgical mask is more effective than a cloth mask. And an N95 is, of course, the most effective, but it's incredibly uncomfortable to wear. So for most people, the recommendation is to wear a good quality either cloth mask or a surgical grade mask as protective equipment.
Okay, and let's turn to boosters here. We actually have a call from Meg in Shrewsbury who has a question about boosters. Meg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question for the doctors?
So my question is this. It's twofold. I'm 6 months pregnant. I'm double vaccinated. I've started masking again. And my question is this.
Actually, Meg, can you turn your radio off? Oh, thank you. Go ahead, Meg.
My radio is that better?
Yep, that's better. Go ahead, Meg. Okay. Continue.
All right, great. So my question is this. As a pregnant person who is double vaccinated, do the doctors think that a booster shot would be appropriate? And going forward, do they see that pregnant women being prioritized in that?
All right, great. Thanks for the call, Meg. Great question. We're going to turn to you, Dr. Landrigan. As I mentioned, there's been reporting, New York Times, elsewhere, now hearing that the new guidance on boosters may come as early as tomorrow. So what's your answer to Meg's question?
Yeah, so I think that if the guidance does call for booster at 6 months or 8 months after the previous vaccination, then everybody who's been vaccinated should follow the guidance and get the booster. We know that immunity wanes over time, and that's the reason for the booster, especially as we're coming into the season of the year with coughs and colds. And certainly pregnant women should be very high on the priority list.
And Dr. Boucher, you know, lots of talk of the two-dose shots, but I'm also thinking about the folks who have gotten the J&J single dose. What are you hearing on boosters and J&J?
Well, you know, just to reconfirm for the listeners, so far we still have no guidance on boosters. We expect it to come. We heard last week from the CDC advisory committee that there still isn't enough data regarding the J&J vaccine to advise for a third dose in our immunocompromised patients. We expect advice soon, and some physicians are recommending an extra dose, a second dose in those people, but we expect advice from the FDA and CDC soon. Likewise, for boosters, we understand that there is less data available so far on the J&J, but there are data that were recently published showing a very good efficacy preventing serious illness and death from the single-dose J&J. So as of today, people vaccinated with the J&J are still considered fully protected.
1-800-423-8255 is the phone number if you'd like to ask a question of Drs. Helen Boucher and Dr. Philip Landrigan. Okay, so Dr. Landrigan, if I could just ask you a question here before turning back to the phones about And thank you, Dr. Boucher, by the way, for the clarification that, yes, the boosters for the vast majority of folks has not been recommended yet. In terms of efficacy, what do we expect the boosters to buy us? Another 8 months or longer? If we've learned anything about this pandemic, it's not like it'll be gone in 8 months. So what will happen then after another 8 months after the booster?
Well, we already know that what the vaccines really do, the most important thing the vaccines do, is they protect against serious illness and they protect against death. They provide something like 99% protection against death. They don't protect us against mild illness, these so-called breakthrough illnesses are proof of that. So I think what the booster will do, if it is approved, and it's not approved yet, of course, but if it's approved, what the booster will do is it'll further strengthen the protection against serious illness and death. And my guess is it probably will give us some partial protection, but not complete protection against breakthrough illnesses.
All right, let's turn to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. Maureen is calling from Merrimack, New Hampshire. Maureen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. My question is, we are set to return back to school full time with no remote option. Everyone will be in without any spacing changes, and there's no mask mandate in our town. As a parent, what can I do to help protect my daughter who is not yet able to be vaccinated?
Great. Thanks for the call, Maureen. Let's throw that one to you, Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, so it's a really good question. And I think that one of the most important things is that your daughter is surrounded by vaccinated individuals. So I very much hope that her teachers and the faculty and staff at the school will all be vaccinated. And she can certainly wear a mask. I think, as Dr. Landrigan pointed out, the American Academy of Pediatrics and many other societies are recommending masks for children because of what's happening with the Delta variant. So it may be, and I hope, that many will wear masks. And that is a protective measure your daughter can take. She can also practice good hand hygiene, especially before and after she eats, and spend as much time as possible outdoors for as long as possible. All those things can help minimize the risk.
Dr. Landrigan, any other advice you'd offer to Maureen?
No, I would completely agree with everything that Dr. Boucher said. And the only item I would add to that is the possibility that you, Maureen, and other parents in Merrimack could push on the local school board and urge them to come up with a mask mandate. If enough parents bind together and pressure the school board, you might affect action.
1-800-423-8255. That's the phone number. Let's go to Lissa in Wayland. Lissa, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hi. So my question is that my children are old enough to understand about COVID and this new variant. We just had a friend that passed away actually last night. And they both have very bad asthma, so they were remote learners, and they're very concerned about returning to school because as I've isolated them, their friends have been living, you know, different lives. They've been much more interactive and social with others, and I've been much more diligent with them. So they actually have fear of returning, and I don't know what to tell them, and I don't know when to ever expect any vaccine to be available to protect them.
Well, first, Lissa, I just want to say, again, sorry for your loss, and make sure to take care of yourself and those around you, okay?
Yes.
And let's turn your question over to Dr. Landrigan.
Well, this is a really tough one. This is a tough one. But my advice is that it's better to get the kids back to school. Children need education. Children need to interact with other kids. Children can't live in a bubble. And I know the world is not risk-free, and I understand completely how worried you must be because of the kids' asthma. But I still think when you balance all the different pieces here, it's better that they should go back to school, and clearly that they should wear masks. And you might, as I said to the woman from Merrimack, New Hampshire, you might want to push on the school board in Wayland to require masks. That's not an unreasonable request, especially since the American Academy of Pediatrics and other medical bodies have made that recommendation. They're ahead of the governor on this. And finally, when the vaccine is approved, hopefully later this fall for children, get your kids at the head of the line to receive that vaccine.
And Dr. Boucher, just jumping off of Lissa's call there, what's the latest, what do we know now today, Tuesday, on the impact of Delta on children?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we have seen rising rates of infection and hospitalization in children with this latest wave of COVID in our country, which we know is driven by the Delta variant. And if we look at states like Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, we've seen really unfortunate numbers of children in the hospital. Thankfully, it's not the case in New England where we have higher rates of vaccination. But as Dr. Landrigan mentioned, we are very concerned about this effect on children. And that's largely what has led to the American Academy of Pediatrics and others, groups like the Infectious Disease Society of America, in advocating for masking and other measures to protect children who can't yet be protected by vaccination.
Got it. Thank you both for those answers. And Lissa, again, we're thinking of you. 1-800-423-8255 is the phone number. I'd like to go to Robert here in Worcester. Robert, you're next on Radio Boston, going back to boosters.
Thank you for fielding my question. I'm curious if there's any evidence to suggest that the booster should be the same versus a different maker than the original.
Yeah, you mean original shot that you already got?
Exactly.
Right. Okay, thank you, Robert, for the call. And again, I just want to reiterate that boosters have not been approved here for full use for everyone, but only for those who are immunocompromised. We are expecting that announcement to come from the federal government this week, but we do not have that yet. Dr. Landrigan, do you want to take this one?
I don't know that there's enough data to make a definitive statement on that. My instinct is to say that it makes more sense if you get a booster, when and if the booster is approved, to get the same vaccine that you got before. But that's just my opinion. It's not an evidence-based statement.
All right, and Dr. Boucher, you know, we've been saying over and over on our Ask the Doctor segments, don't vaccine shop, get whichever vaccine is available, and then stick with that one. And I'm just wondering what you're seeing in the data, in the research, in terms of the differences between the vaccines and their efficacy.
Well, you know, I think the overwhelming message in terms of the efficacy is that all three vaccines are incredibly effective at preventing severe illness and death, which is what they were designed to do. We have seen some differences in reports of preventing mild infection, and interpreting those data gets very complicated because different populations studied at different times, but it may be, you know, that one is less effective than the other at preventing mild illness. But the take home is that all three are above 90% effective in preventing serious illness and death, and that's really the main thing for us to think about with vaccination.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Angela in Cambridge. Angela, you're next on Ask the Doctors on Radio Boston.
Yes. I live in a building for elderly and disabled people. There's a workman here who's recovered from COVID but has never been vaccinated. Is it safe for him to be in this building?
And Angela, have you been vaccinated? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. Thanks for the call, Angela. Dr. Boucher.
So, Angela, we know that there is immunity after natural infection. So this gentleman is going to be protected at least for a few months. I hope he will get vaccinated because that will provide him better protection that will last longer. And the good news is that you're vaccinated. You may want to wear a mask if he's coming into your apartment. But I think all in all, he is safe to be among you at this time.
Let's go to Christy in Hopkinton. Christy, you're next on Radio Boston.
Hey, thank you. I'm calling to ask you what when people are vaccinated and there are breakthrough cases, and I know there's a very low chance of death, but do you have any insight into if those deaths are related to people that have pre-existing conditions?
Got it. Thank you, Christy. Dr. Landrigan.
I don't know for sure. I mean, I would think that somebody who had a pre-existing condition would be at greater risk of death if they had a breakthrough infection. And I say that because we know that when back in the spring, when the epidemic was raging, that most of the deaths occurred among people with pre-existing conditions. But I don't have hard data on that one. Maybe Dr. Boucher would have.
Yeah,
that.
Dr. Boucher, do you have anything else to add there for?
Yeah, well, you know, we have really quite good data now that the deaths that have been seen in the era of vaccination are largely in unvaccinated individuals, and then the few among vaccinated individuals are in those immunocompromised people that we talked about earlier, for whom third dose has now been recommended. So people who've had cancer, chemotherapy, and organ transplant, you know, severe immunosuppression. So again, the good news is that in the non-immunosuppressed, we have seen very, very few deaths from breakthrough infections.
Got it. Thank you, Dr. Boucher. And, you know, I want to ask a question. I know we heard Dr. Anthony Fauci way back at the beginning of this segment, you know, sort of imploring people to get vaccinated, and because, you know, the more spread that we have, the greater opportunity the virus has to evolve and mutate. And so I wanted to ask you both, what are we seeing on the mutation front beyond Delta? Dr. Landrigan.
Well, so far, we know we have excellent data that the vaccines protect against Delta. Delta is highly contagious, but the vaccines protect against it. The researchers are being very vigilant, looking for the emergence of any new strains, and that's an area of worry and concern. But right now, I want to emphasize and reemphasize what Dr. Boucher and I have both said, that the vaccines give enormous protection, 99% protection against death, and 95% protection against serious hospitalization from COVID. And the epidemic that's raging now in Florida and Texas and some of the other southern states is basically, as Dr. Walensky of CDC has said, it's an epidemic among the unvaccinated. People got to get vaccinated. If people aren't vaccinated, please get vaccinated. That's the important thing.
So we just have just about a minute here. And so, Dr. Boucher, I was wondering, finally, if I could ask you, what are you looking for on the road ahead as schools reopen, as folks return to offices here in the fall, or at least are planning to? What are you looking for?
Well, we're going to continue to keep our eyes on the data, especially the data about hospitalization and death. And we're going to continue to work to communicate with everyone about the importance of keeping up with all these protective measures, right? Getting vaccinated if you haven't gotten vaccinated yet, considering masking in the appropriate setting, lots of hand hygiene, not going to work or school when you're sick. We haven't talked about that today, but that is vitally important. Right. And getting tested if and when you develop symptoms. Those are the things that all of us can do to really increase the chances of a successful school year and a successful transition of back to in-person work.
Well, great. That's Dr. Helen Boucher. She's an infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, the interim dean of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Dr. Boucher, always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Thank you as well, Dr. Landrigan.
Thank you, Jamie. Good to be here.
And listeners, just adding a quick reminder here, as with all medical advice, please consult your own doctor and take whichever course of action is best for you and your situation. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.